Good afternoon, everybody. Shmuel Platzer coming at you live. It's our weekly book club class. I'm outside Mark's Bagels. It's a little bit loud in there, and thankfully it's a little bit busy. I'm happy for that, but it would impinge upon the audio on this class. So we're going to do this in the car, and we are going to begin the study of Kol Dodi Dofeik. Listen, my beloved knocks. More literally, the voice of my beloved knocks. However you want to translate it, it's a beautiful work by Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik. It was delivered to the Religious Zionists of America on the occasion of the 8th Yom HaAtzmut, the 8th anniversary of Israel's independence in 1956. He said it in Yiddish. It was then retooled, rewritten into Hebrew, and then translated into English in 1990. And that's when it kind of hit the English-speaking world. 33 years ago. We're studying Rabbi Soloveitchik. He was born 120 years ago this year, in the year 1903. He passed in the year 1993, and so we're celebrating his 120th anniversary of his birth, 30th anniversary of his passing. And without further ado, Kol Dodi Dofeik. It discusses the religious significance of the creation of the State of Israel and the obligation that its existence imposes upon Jews. Small little thin volume, chapter 1, The Righteous Suffer. Here he's going to be exploring suffering. Why do we go through it? He'll be exploring fate and destiny. Chapter 1, page 1, The Righteous Suffer. One of the deepest of mysteries troubling Judaism from the dawn of its existence is the problem of suffering. At a propitious moment of divine compassion, Moses, the master of all prophets, pleaded before the God of all to be enlightened as to the workings of this impenetrable phenomenon. Moses knocked on the gates of heaven and cried out, "Show me now your ways, that I shall comprehend you, so that I might find grace in your eyes. Instruct me as to your glory." See Exodus 33. Why and wherefore are hardships visited on men? Why and wherefore do the righteous suffer and evildoers prosper? From that wondrous morning when Moses, the faithful shepherd, communed with the creator of the universe and pleaded for the comprehensive solution to this question of questions, throughout the generations, the prophets and sages of Israel have grappled with this conundrum. Habakkuk the prophet demanded satisfaction for this affront to justice. Jeremiah, King David in his Psalms, and Solomon in Ecclesiastes all pondered this problem. The book of Job is totally dedicated to this ancient riddle that still hovers over our world and demands its own resolution. Why does the Almighty, the Holy One, blessed be He, permit evil to have dominion over His creations? Page 2. Judaism, in quest for a safe harbor in a world split and dismembered by existential suffering, and in its search for a solution to the mystery of the suffering that to all outward appearances pervades without limits, Judaism came to a new formulation and definition of this problem that has both greater breadth and greater depth. Posing the question of suffering, claims Judaism, is possible in two separate dimensions, the dimension of fate and the dimension of destiny. Judaism has always distinguished between an existence of fate and an existence of destiny, between the I, meaning I as a human being, I do this and I do that, between the I, which is the progeny of fate, and the I, again referring to me, myself, and the I, which is the child of destiny. In this distinction lies hidden the Jewish doctrine of suffering. What is an existence of fate? It is an existence of duress in the nature of against your will, you do live. See the Mishnah in Avos, Mishnah Avos 4, Mishnah 29. It is a factual existence, simply one line in a long chain of mechanical causality, devoid of significance, direction, and purpose, and subordinate to the forces of the environment into whose midst the individual is pushed, unconsulted by providence. In other words, you're going to get pushed around. If you're in the fate category, you don't take much action. You're merely an object. You're getting acted upon. The I of fate emerges as an object. As an object, man appears as acted upon, not as an actor. He is acted upon through his passive collision with the objective outside, as one object confronting another. The I of fate is hurled into a sealed dynamic that is always turned outward. Man's existence is hollow, lacking inner content, substance, and independence. The I of fate denies itself completely because the sense of selfhood and objectification cannot dwell in tandem. It is against such a background that the experience of evil surfaces in all its terror. There are two stages in fate slash existence. From the start, the man as object, imprisoned against his will, bound up in the chains of existence, stands perplexed and confused in the face of the great mystery called suffering. Fate mocks him. His existence, crazed and torn, opposes itself and denies its work and its importance. The fear of extinction assails him and crushes his body and soul. The sufferer wanders lost in the vacuousness of the world, with God's fear spread over him and his anger tensed against it. He, man, is entirely shaken and agitated. His agonies are devoid of any clear meaning, and they appear as satanic forces, as outgrowths of the primal chaos that pollutes the creation, whose destiny it was to be a reflection of the Creator. At this stage of perplexity and speechlessness, of numbness of the heart and confusion of the mind, man does not ask at all about the reason for evil and its essence. He simply suffers in silence and is choked by his anguish, which silences his complaint and suppresses questioning and inquiry. After the psychic quaking of the sufferer, which comes as a first reaction to suffering, comes the intellectual curiosity of the sufferer, which seeks to understand existence and to strengthen the sufferer's safety and security. Page 4. At this stage, man begins to examine suffering and to ask weighty questions. He searches for the rational foundations of suffering and evil. And he endeavors to find the tranquility and harmony that lie between the positive and negative, and thus to remove the edge from the tension between the thesis, good, and the antithesis, evil, of existence. From the question and the inquiry, the solution and the answer, he arrives at a metaphysical formulation of evil, through which he comes to terms with evil and attempts to gloss it over. The sufferer employs the powers of rational abstraction with which the Creator endowed him, to the point of self-deception, denial of the existence of evil in the world. Judaism, with its realistic approach to man and his status within existence, understood that evil does not lend itself to being obscured and glossed over, and that every attempt to diminish the import of the contrast and cleavage in existence will not bring man to inner peace or to comprehension of the existential secret. Evil is a fact that cannot be denied. There is evil in the world. There are suffering and agony and death pangs. He who would deceive himself by ignoring the split in existence and by romanticizing life is but a fool and a fabricator of illusions. It is impossible to conquer monstrous evil with philosophical speculative thought. Thus, Judaism determined that man, submerged in the depths of a frozen fate, will in vain seek the solution to the problem of evil in the context of speculative thought, for he will never find it. Certainly the testimony of the Torah regarding creation, that, quote, it is very good, Genesis 1, is true. However, this is only stated from the unbounded perspective of the Creator. Man's finite, limited view, the absolute good in creation, is not apparent. The contrast is striking and undeniable. There is evil that is not susceptible to explanation and comprehension. Only by comprehending the world in its totality can man gain insight into the essence of suffering. However, as long as man's perception is limited and fragmented, so that he sees only isolated portions of the cosmic drama and the mighty saga of history, he cannot delve into the recesses of evil and the mystery of suffering. To what might this situation be compared? To a person who views a beautiful tapestry, the work of a fine artisan, which contains, woven into it on its front, a representation dazzling to the eye. To our great sorrow, we see this image, that is, the world, from the obverse side. Can such a sight become a sublime, aesthetic experience? Thus, we are incapable of comprehending the panorama of reality without which one cannot uncover God's master plan, the essence of the works of the Holy One. In short, the I, me myself and I, of fate asks a speculative, metaphysical question about evil. And this question is not given to solution and has no answer. In the second dimension of man's existence, destiny, the question of suffering takes on a new form. What is an existence of destiny? It is an active existence. When man confronts the environment into which he has been cast with an understanding of his uniqueness and value, freedom and capacity, without compromising his integrity and independence in his struggle with the outside world. Page 6. The slogan of the I of destiny is, against your will you are born, and against your will you will die, says the Mishnah. End quote. But by your free will you do live. Man is born as an object, dies as an object, but it is within his capability to live as a subject, as a creator and innovator who impresses his individual imprimatur on his life and breaks out of a life of instinctive automatic behavior into one of creative activity. According to Judaism, man's mission in this world is to turn fate into destiny, an existence that is passive and influenced into an existence that is active and influential. An existence of compulsion, perplexity, and speechlessness into an existence full of will, vision, and initiative. The blessing of God to his creation fully defines man's role. Quote, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it. Genesis 1, verse 28. Conquer the environment and subjugate it. If you do not rule over it, it will enslave you. Destiny bestows on man a new status in God's world. It bestows upon man a royal crown. And thus, man becomes God's partner in the work of creation. As stated above, in man's existence of destiny, arises a new relation to the problem of evil. As long as man vacillates in his fateful existence, his relationship to evil is expressed solely in a philosophical, speculative approach. As a passive creature, it was not within his power to wrestle with evil in order to contain or to exploit it for an exalted purpose. The child of fate is devoid of the ability to determine anything in the realm of his existence. Top page 7. He is nurtured from the outside, and his life bears its imprint. Therefore, he relates to evil from an impractical perspective and philosophizes about it from a speculative point of view. He wishes to deny the reality of evil and to create a harmonistic outlook on life. The result of such an experience is bitter disappointment. Evil mocks the prisoner of fate and his fantasy of a reality that is all good and pleasant. However, in the realm of destiny, man recognizes reality as it is and does not desire to use harmonizing formulas in order to hide and disregard evil. The, quote, child of destiny is very realistic and does not flinch in anticipation of a face-to-face confrontation with evil. His approach is halachic, in accordance with traditional Jewish law, and moral, and thus devoid of any metaphysical speculative nuance. When the child of destiny suffers, he says in his heart, quote, there is evil. I do not deny it, and I will not conceal it with fruitless casuistry. I am, however, interested in it from a halachic point of view, and as a person who wants to know what action to take, I ask a single question. What should the sufferer do to live with his suffering? End quote. In this dimension, the emphasis is removed from causal and teleological considerations, which differ only as to direction, and is directed to the realm of action. The problem is now formulated in the language of a simple halacha and revolves around a quotidian that is daily task. The question of questions is, what does suffering obligate man to do? Top of page 8. This problem was important to Judaism, which placed it at the center of its Weltanschauung, German for world outlook. Halacha is just as interested in this question as in issues of Isser and Heter, permitted things and non-permitted things, and Chiyuv and Pater, obligations and exemptions. We do not wonder about the ineffable ways of the Almighty, but instead, we ponder the paths man must take when evil leaps up at him. We ask not about the reason for evil and its purpose, but rather about its rectification and uplifting. How should a man react in a time of distress? What should a person do so as not to rot in his affliction? The halachic answer to this question is very simple. Suffering comes to elevate man, to purify his spirit, and to sanctify him, to cleanse his mind, and purify it from the chaff of superficiality and the dross of crudeness, to sensitize his soul and expand his horizons. In general, the purpose of suffering is to repair the imperfection in man's persona. The halacha teaches us that an afflicted person commits a criminal act if he allows his pain to go for naught and to remain without meaning or purpose. Suffering appears in the world in order to contribute something to man, in order to atone for him, in order to redeem him from moral impurity, from crudeness and lowliness of spirit. The sufferer must arise therefrom, purified, refined, and cleansed. Quote, an hour of distress it is for Jacob, and from it he should be saved. See Jeremiah 30. From the midst of suffering itself, he will achieve lasting redemption and merit a self-actualization and exaltation that are unequaled in a world devoid of suffering. Type of nine. From negation sprouts affirmation. From antithesis, thesis emerges. And from a denial of existence, a new existence is revealed. The Torah gave witness to man's mighty spiritual reaction to suffering inflicted upon him when the Torah said, quote, in your distress, when all these horrors shall come upon you, then you shall return to God your God. Deuteronomy 4. Suffering requires man to repent and to return to God. Distress is designated to arouse us to repentance. And what is repentance if not the renewal and supreme redemption of man? How pitiful if man's sufferings do not bring him to a spiritual crisis and his soul remains frozen and bereft of forgiveness. How pitiful is the sufferer if his soul is not warmed by the flame of suffering and if his wounds do not spark, quote, the candle of God. See Proverbs 20. Within him. When pain wanders in the wide world as a blind force without purpose, a stinging indictment of the man who squanders his suffering issues forth. Judaism made this notion more profound when it combined the idea of the repair, the tikkun of evil, and its elevation with the perfection and elevation of goodness. Judaism states that the kindnesses of God are not given to man as an unconditional gift without obligation. They require something in return. Their very essence imposes a moral, halachic demand upon the man who enjoys them. Top of page 10. Indeed, while loving kindness emanates from the open, overflowing, generous hand of the Almighty, it is not an unlimited or unconditional gift. Such a gift is not absolute. The bestowing of good is always conditional and temporary. Do you see where he's going? He's going to say that all the kindnesses of God are given to us not as an unconditional gift without obligation. You've got to thank the Almighty. You have to acknowledge the gift. Thank you for my good health. Thank you for my wealth. Thank you for a loving home. Thank you for loving parents. Thank you for good teachers. Thank you for siblings. Thank you for everything you've given me. Then you're becoming worthy, right? Otherwise, it's ridiculous. God hands out all these goodies, and a human being doesn't acknowledge any of it. How crazy is that? What kind of a life is that? Not Judaism. It's not a Jewish life. And eventually, he's going to come out of the state of Israel. You see, that's where he's going, right? It's a great gift that God gave. And it's incumbent upon Jewish people to say, thank you, God. And that's why he walked away from Yehuda and joined the Mizrahi. I'm bavorting this. I'm anticipating this. Because the Yehuda, to this day, cannot acknowledge the state of Israel. Can't even talk about it. When you don't even talk about a gift, you are rejecting the gift. If you don't even acknowledge it, that it exists, how could you ever say thank you for it? When you get a gift at your birthday, right? Oh, my, thank you so much. What are you thanking me for? You gave me something. So you're acknowledging it and you're thanking me for it. That's how human beings are supposed to be. My little boy got bar mitzvah. He was showered with gifts. Thank God he's got to write the thank you letters now. He acknowledges receipt of the gift. How could a Jew look at the state of Israel and not acknowledge that as a tremendous gift? How in the world? 2,000 years of aggravation, suffering, pogroms, crusades, blood libels, Khmelnytsky, and all topped off with the Holocaust. And now you have your own country. You don't say thank you? Crazy. I mean, whether you live there or not, it's one thing. But to at least acknowledge it exists? Unbelievable. I'm sure that's where he's going. I'll read it again. The kindnesses of God are not given to man as an unconditional gift without obligation. They require something in return. Their very essence imposes a moral, halachic demand upon the man who enjoys them. Indeed, while loving kindness emanates from the open, overflowing, generous hand of God, it's not an unlimited or unconditional gift. Such a gift is not absolute. The bestowing of good is always conditional and temporary. When God bestows wealth, property, influence, and honor, the recipient must know how to employ them, how to turn these precious gifts into fruitful creative powers, how to include others in his happiness and greatness, and how to render loving kindness with the divine kindnesses that emanate and issue forth to him from a never-ending font. God gives you goodness, gotta share it. Gives you wealth, gotta spread it around. Gives you good health, spread it around. You can't just keep that for yourself. If an abundance of good does not bring man to absolute subordination to God, then man is guilty of a fundamental sin, resulting in the severe distress that in turn reminds him of his obligation to the creator of the universe for the gift of God's kindnesses. Our great sages have taught, quote, man is obligated to give thanks for evil as he does for goodness. See the Mishnah in Brachos chapter 9. Just as good obliges man to perform deeds of a higher order and demands creative and innovative actions from the individual or the populace, so does suffering require the repair of the soul and the cleansing of life. If at the time of God's favor and beneficence, one was not aroused to action. For it happens that man is summoned to repair through his afflictions the damage he caused in God's creation at the hour when God extended his bounty. Top 11, the feeling of subordination to God and the understanding of one's obligation to purify and sanctify oneself by dint of one's suffering must brighten man's soul when he finds himself in distress and perplexed by his existence. What am I doing here? Why am I suffering all this? Why am I going through this aggravation? Unemployment, loss of family, loss of life, poverty, illness, name it, whatever it is. It's terrible, right? But it's there to refine a person and draw you closer to God. Then thus becomes man's obligation to purify and sanctify his own his own person by dint of his suffering. And by doing so, he brightens his own soul when he finds himself in distress and perplexed by his existence. That is an invitation to brighten up your soul and acknowledge, what am I doing here? I was created. Why was I created? Clearly to do something of importance. Who created me? God Almighty did that. What does he want from me? Let me think about that. Let me explore it. What gifts did he give me? Intelligence, health, good looks, a way to make a living, and things like that, or to make a person think deep and long about that and channel all those gifts that you're given into helping others. So don't just wallow in your pity. That's not why God is hitting you with that suffering. It's a chance for you to brighten up your soul, believe it or not, as you get closer to God. Many don't see that. Man must overcome the obtuseness of his heart that caused him to sin when he stood in the presence of God's bounty. In short, man must solve not the question of the causal or teleological reason for suffering with all its speculative complexity, but rather the question of its curative role in all its halachic simplicity by turning fate to destiny and elevating himself from object to subject, from thing to man. And now, chapter 2, which will link up with this, and we have time to do it. Job, Eve of the Book of Job fame of the Bible. Indeed, page 13, this is the answer that was given by the Creator to Job. As long as Job, as a slave of faith, philosophized about reasons and motives and demanded insight into the essence of evil, continually asking and murmuring, why and wherefore does suffering come? The Almighty answered him sharply with the pointed question, did you know? As we see in Job chapter 39. See Job 38. Did you know who it is who darkens counsel by speaking words without knowledge? Meaning, of course, Job. Gird up now your loins like a man. For I will demand of you, God says, and you shall declare unto me, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare, if you have such understanding. Do you know the time when the wild goats of the rock will give birth, when the hinds will calf? End quote. If you do not know the alphabet of creation, why be so impudent as to ask questions about the workings of the world? But once Job realized how strange his question was and how great his ignorance, and acknowledged it, and was not ashamed to say, quote, therefore I have uttered that which I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I know not. Job 42. Then God was able to reveal to this man of destiny the true principles which are concealed in suffering, as expressed by the halakha. The Almighty said, Job, true, you will never understand the inner essence of the why, the reason for suffering, and its purpose. But there is one thing that you are obligated to know, the basis for the repair of suffering. Page 14. If by your suffering you are able to elevate yourself to the spiritual level that you have not heretofore attained, you will then know that your travail was intended as a device for your perfection in both spirit and soul. Job, when my graciousness engulfed you in the manner expressed by the prophet Isaiah in 66, behold, I will extend prosperity to him like a river. And you were well known, Job, and you, Job, were a man of influence. Quote, and this man was the greatest of all the children of the East. See Job 1. Job, you did not fulfill the role that my grace placed upon you. You were a sound and just man, God-fearing and avoiding of evil. You did not use your power and wealth for ill. True. You gave much to charity. Righteousness I wore, and it robed me. My justice was a robe and a turban, says Job 24, 29. Job 29. God says to him, you did not hesitate to offer assistance and support to others, and you stood by them in their hour of peril and distress. See Job 29 again. Did I not deliver the poor that cried out and the orphan that had none to help him? However, God says to Job, you were still short of attaining that great trait of loving kindness in two respects. One, never did you bear the communal yoke, nor did you participate in the trouble and the grief of the community. And two, you did not feel the pain. That is, you did not empathize with the individual sufferer. As a man blessed with a good heart, you may have momentarily pitied the orphan. You had vast amounts of money and you wanted for nothing. Hence, you gave a respectable amount of tzedakah. However, loving kindness encompasses more than fleeting sentiment and cheap sentimentality. Loving kindness demands more than a momentary tear and a cold coin. Loving kindness means empathizing with one's fellow man, identifying with his hurt, and feeling responsibility for his fate. You did not possess this attribute of overflowing loving kindness in imitation of the Creator, neither in your public nor in your personal relationships. You were a contemporary of Jacob, who wrestled with Laban and Esav and the angel at the stream of Yabok. Did you help Yaakov, Jacob, with advice? Who was Yaakov? A poor shepherd. And you? You were rich and a man of influence. Had you related to Yaakov with appropriate sympathy and with steadfast loving kindness, he would not have had to pass through such a multitude of tribulations. You lived in the time of Moses, and you were numbered among the advisors of Pharaoh. Did you lift a finger when Pharaoh issued his evil decree that every son that is born shall cast into the river? See Exodus 1. Or when the oppressors enslaved your brethren with backbreaking work, you were silent then and did not protest, for you were afraid of identifying yourself with the unfortunate slaves. Toss them a coin? Yes. But to publicly demonstrate for them? No. You were afraid that you would be accused of dual loyalty. You were active in the generation of Ezra and Nehemiah, the returnees to Zion. You, Job, with your wealth and influence, could have hastened the process of settling the land of Israel and rebuilding the temple. However, your ear was deafened and did not heed the historical cries of the nation. You did not storm out in protest against the Sanballites, the Samaritans, and the rest of Israel's enemies who wanted to destroy the Yishuv and extinguish the spark of the last hope of God's people. What did you do in the hour when the returnees from the diaspora cried out from the depths of suffering and despair, quote, in Nehemiah chapter 4, the strength of the bearers of the burdens has faltered, and there is much rubbish, so that we are not able to build the wall. You sat with folded arms. You did not participate in the travail of those who fought for Judaism, for Israel, and the redemption. Never did you bring even one sacrifice on their behalf. All these years you worried only about your own welfare, and only for your own benefit did you pray and offer sacrifices. See Job 1, quote, and so it was when the days of their feasting were over that Job sent word to his children to sanctify themselves, and he, Job, rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offerings for each of them all. For Job said, quote, it may be that my sons have sinned and blasphemed God in their hearts, end quote. Only for your own benefit, your own welfare. Did you once, Job, participate in a stranger's grief to the extent of making a plea on his behalf? No, you did not. Do you know, Joe, that prayer is the province of the community, and that an individual does not come before God to plead before him and request the fulfillment of his needs until he redeems himself from isolation and self-containment and joins the community? Did you forget that Jewish prayer speaks in the plural? Gemara and Brachos, one should always join together with the community in prayer. Brachos 3a. And that Jewish prayer is the linking of one soul to another and the fusing of tempestuous hearts. You did not know how to use the formula for prayer fixed by the nation, which is to include yourself within the community and to help bear the burden of one's fellow man. If your soul wants to comprehend the doctrine of the amelioration of suffering, you must grasp the secret of prayer that brings the I close to the other. The original formula that joins the individual with the experience of the community must become, for you, second nature. And you must understand the idea of loving kindness, which is realized by the one who prays and who is elevated from a personal self-concern to becoming one with the community. You will not fulfill your obligation by generously dispensing the miserable pennies with which you were blessed. You will only be saved through prayer, resulting from the experience of community, communal travail. You did not understand the teaching of Chesed, and you squandered my blessings, says God. Try now to comprehend the lesson of suffering. Perhaps out of pain and grief, you can undo the errors you committed out of illusory comfort and happiness. God said to the friends of Job, quote, "Now therefore, take unto you 7 bulls and 7 rams, and go to my servant Job, and offer up for yourselves a burnt offering, and my servant Job shall pray for you." Job 42. Behold, top of 19. Behold, I will test Job yet another time. Let him be tested publicly. Does he now know how to pray for others and participate in their travail? Did he learn anything in the hour of retribution and divine anger? Did he adopt for himself a new style of collective prayer that encompasses the community? If he pleads for you, he will bring his salvation and yours. For to him I will show favor. Job 42. Then you shall know that Job was redeemed from the narrow straits of egotism and entered into the vistas of communal empathy, and that social isolation has ended and communal affiliation has appeared in its stead. A wonderful thing happened. Job suddenly understood the nature of Jewish prayer. He discovered in one moment its plural voice and the attribute of loving kindness that sweeps man from the private to the public domain. He began to live a communal life, to feel the community's hurts, to mourn its disasters, and rejoice in its moments of celebration. Job's sufferings found their true repair in his escape from the prison in which he had found himself. And God's wrath was assuaged, as it is written, quote, "And the Almighty changed the fortunes of Job when he prayed for his friends." Job 42. My dear friends, that's what we have for you today. Powerful stuff. The difference between fate and destiny and how that dichotomy lends itself an explanation of suffering. And what is suffering? It's not a purification of the soul and a chance to get close to God. And Job, what a lesson we learned. How one moment is all about himself. Yeah, doing some things, a little bit here, a little bit there, but not with the full heart that God requires of a Jew. Well, I thank you all for coming out. God willing, we will continue this wonderful book. We'll start chapter 3 next week. Chapter 3 is Missing the Appointed Hour. Don't miss out on this last work of a celebration we'll be doing for a while. This is the concluding work of our year-long appreciation and study of Rebbe Soloveitchik. Do not miss out on a single minute. God willing, we'll see you next week at 1 o'clock again. Thank you all so much for coming out to the Gulf Manor Synagogue School of Jewish Studies on the road outside Mark's Bagels here in Blue Ash. God's help, we'll see everybody live in shul tomorrow night for Tanakh Tuesday as we continue our study of 2 Kings. We're about 12 verses in. Don't miss out. We're almost at the end of that book. So please join us for that. Wishing everybody a good day, a safe day. I humbly ask the Almighty to take any schus that we have for this Limud HaTorah that we just did, this beautiful piece for Rebbe Soloveitchik, and attribute it to the benefit of the State of Israel and all those who live in it, and the Israel Defense Forces, may they be successful. And a refuah shleima to all the Israelis who were injured in the atrocity of October 7th, and to all the Israelis and others who are being held hostage by the Hamas Nazis throughout Gaza. Dear God, please release the hostages. Please heal those who are in the hospitals, and please give strength and success to the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces. Wishing everybody a very, very good day. Night Gizun Kol Tov, be well, and we'll see you tomorrow night for Tanakh Tuesday at Gulf Manor Synagogue at 7:30. Take care and be well. School Plotka signing off now for GMS and the School of Jewish Studies. Thanks so much. Bye-bye now.